Hello, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. Back in 2020, we invited Katrina Menzies-Pike, editor of the Sydney Review of Books, to interview four renowned critics about the future of literary criticism. We're now pleased to release these fascinating conversations. In this podcast episode, Katrina talks to acclaimed critics Declan Frye and Bernadette Brennan.
Welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival podcast. My name is Katrina Menzies-Pike, and it's my great pleasure to be talking to four critics, Bernadette Brennan, Declan Frye, Daniel Mendelsohn, and Michael Sun, about criticism in 2020. I'm recording this on Gadigal land, which is the land on which I live and work. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land and pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. The struggles for justice are ongoing, and sovereignty was never ceded. I'd like to acknowledge all the traditional custodians of the lands this podcast reaches. Now, we were all originally scheduled to meet at the Sydney Writers Festival back in May. When this panel was organised, we didn't have any notion that COVID-19 would shut the festival down. We didn't have any idea of the tremendous impact that COVID would have on writers and literary culture through 2020. This impact has registered in all kinds of ways. Book releases have been deferred for months or years, if not cancelled. Public events, an important income stream for writers, they've been cancelled. Bookshops are shut, book sales are unpredictable, and the public sphere has been dominated by the coronavirus. There's no doubt that it's been hard for authors to capture public attention, to connect with their readers. This is where critics come in, and it's where I enter the scene too, in a fashion. I'm the editor of a journal called the Sydney Review of Books. Long reviews of new Australian and international works anchor our program. This year, in spite of the coronavirus, or perhaps because of it, I've been hearing a lot more public discussion than usual about the responsibility of critics to authors and to readers. Negative reviews have prompted impassioned responses. In a year that's been extremely tough on authors, especially debut authors, should critics go easy? The larger conversations about diversity and the social and cultural institutions that shape our lives have raised new questions too about the boundaries of criticism and the responsibilities of critics. I've put a set of questions about criticism in this difficult year to four very different critics: Daniel Mendelsohn, Declan Frye, Michael Sun, and Bernadette Brennan. As you'll hear, there's no such thing as critical consensus. I hope you enjoy sifting through their answers and forming your own position. Bernadette Brennan is a critic and researcher of contemporary Australian writing. Her most recent book is A Writing Life, a biography of Helen Garner. Bernadette's literary criticism has been published widely in Australia and abroad. She's currently writing a biography of Gillian Mears, and she's the recipient of the Copyright Agency's inaugural fellowship for nonfiction. Declan Frye is an essayist, critic, and proud descendant of the Yorta Yorta. Born on Wongatha country in Kalgoorlie, in 2020 he was selected as an emerging critic for The Age and Sydney Morning Herald, and he was shortlisted for the Lord Mayor's Creative Writing Award. He currently lives on unceded Wurundjeri land and is a board member and volunteer at Books and Boots. You can read his work in Mianjin, The Australian Book Review, Kill Your Darlings, The Sydney Review of Books, and Overland. To get us started, could you introduce yourself and talk a little about your formation as a critic?
Yeah, so my name's Bernadette Brennan, and I guess my formation as a critic began in my academic days. As an academic, it was incumbent on me to write articles, to publish them in peer-reviewed journals, with the same intention as more general criticism, as in to elucidate works of literature, to help readers find access points. But the intention in those days was more about the historical scholarly record. So I would write longer, more detailed, more academic criticism about certain works with an eye to increasing the scholastic understanding of them. Occasionally I'd do more general reviews, criticism in places like ABR, Australian Book Review, or in Spectrum. That was quite a different form of criticism. In my academic days, and probably in the years post then, the first couple of years post then, I left in 2014, I would also do a significant amount of peer review. And I saw that as part of my critical work, to read other writers' criticism and give feedback on that. Since leaving teaching, I haven't done a huge amount of single pieces of criticism. I've done certainly a couple of long pieces for Sydney Review of Books, which I love precisely because it allows you to extend your thinking and it asks you implicitly to read widely and read deeply, particularly around the work of a writer that you might be talking about. So that kind of criticism appeals to me greatly. In terms of shorter, more general critical reviews, I've taken a step back for two reasons. Firstly, because I think I've had my time. I'm older, I'm white, I'm educated, I'm pretty privileged. And there's two generations, actually, at least, of critics that have come after me. And they're far more diverse, they've got interesting voices, they've got different experiences, and I want to hear from them. And so I think that's a very exciting development in criticism. The other thing I've done since then is I've focused on writing books. And so I wrote a biography of Helen Garner, which was, well, it's a biography in inverted commas. It was about her writing. And so that was a different form of criticism, but it was to me a critical piece of explicating her writing, asking readers if they're interested to go back and read her writing. And I'm doing the same thing now with Gillian Mears. So I'm still, if you like, a literary critic, but I'm not actually as published and as widely dispersed, I think, maybe as I once was.
My name's Declan Fry. In terms of getting started as a critic, I just thought it would be part of the day job, that it was something you did. And if you wanted to be a writer, then there would always be a question of commentary on things, and that it was just a natural part of the gig, you know. So I sort of expect to be asked or to ask people, when is the collection of poetry coming out? When's the collection of criticism arriving? And it's not something I specifically saw myself being in exclusively. So I will add that during COVID, I hadn't published before. I've got, you know, a lot of unpublished writing. I've kind of spent a decade or so just observing and reading and writing, and I figured that was part of the apprenticeship as well, that there'd be a few kind of squalid novels tucked away in a drawer, never to see the light of day or afflict any member of the reading public. So they're still sitting there. And it was this year I decided to quit law and write. So I've only started publishing criticism or any sort of writing since after COVID hit.
So for you, criticism is part of the day job of being a writer. It's part of what forms you as a writer.
Yeah, I think it's similar to the idea about wanting to write what you would like to read. So I always took great pleasure in seeing writers that I liked and what they said about just what was happening in the world, whether that was book reviews or commentary. And I still long to hear, you know, what does Zadie Smith think about New Order? You know, what does any given writer think about a topic? And that was what attracted me as just part of writing, because I think genre distinctions, they're of interest to maybe academics or publishers, but without wanting to sound precious, you know, writing is writing for artists. It's all just another medium. So I think you still have the same fidelity and loyalty to what you're trying to do as a writer, whether it is critique or it is fiction or it is nonfiction or anything else.
I'm really interested in critical practice in 2020. I've been talking to contributors to the Sydney Review of Books this year, and my sense is that a lot of them are having a very difficult time. And that's not only because freelance opportunities have dried up, because many of them have new care responsibilities within their families, but because the kind of attention span required to read closely, to think deeply, to develop complex arguments about cultural artifacts, about books, is really, really hard to attain. I wonder how you found being a writer and critical thinking in this long, difficult year.
Yes, well, I'm fortunate in that I don't have small children at home anymore to mind. I've been there, done that, but I certainly didn't have to do it during COVID. And all the people I know that have had to do that, the tax on them has been enormous. And I don't understand how they could possibly think deeply and have sustained periods of thinking and then writing. So that makes perfect sense why they're finding it so hard. I have treated COVID as a form of withdrawal from the world pretty much. And because I was working on a manuscript on this particular biography, I have shut out as much as possible other thinking and other reading, and I have actually managed to focus very intently on that particular manuscript. So I have actually done a lot of writing this year, but it's extremely focused, and even that is a problem, and I'm worried that my focus is so narrow. Yes, I have managed to read, and I've tried to read as much as possible books from all around the world, because as a literary judge, I have to read a lot of Australian books at the beginning and the end of every year. So in the middle of the year, I try and read as widely as I can outside of Australian literature. And some of those books I've remembered very clearly and I've engaged with deeply, and a lot of them I haven't. And I think that's part of this lack of concentration. I've wasted hours doom scrolling through Twitter, hours. But on the other hand, I've felt the need to. It's this sense of maybe that's some kind of connection, but concentration, yes, not good.
Yeah, I made a really wise decision, which was to quit law just before COVID happened and become unemployed just after COVID arrived, which is a one way to approach it. If it ever happens again, I can advise it's not the best way. And I sort of remembered thinking, oh, how am I going to get published? And I had no contacts. I had no experience of any aspect of the industry. And as I say, I was unpublished. And I remember contacting Westerly, and there was an editor there. And I sort of said, oh, I love this book, Blueberries by Eleanor Savage. Can I maybe write about it? And he said, yeah. And I kind of stopped and said, okay. And then it was a bit like a Beckett play where I didn't know what was meant to happen next because there was no deadline or commission. And I sort of wondered what was going on. This person was literally just telling me, yeah. And that was actually the first thing I wrote and might have been the first thing that was published, but it came out a little while later. And after that, I have no comparison point. I can't say what it would be like to publish pre-COVID. But I can say publishing during COVID, it was an experience, I suppose, where the self-communion is the same. You're still internally going through and communing with yourself to write about things, and you're having these internal conversations as a critic with the books that you read. It's essentially the same thing that a reader experiences, where you are having a conversation with the author and with the book. The critic is just someone who has to kind of take those thoughts and cook them up and then serve them to people at the restaurant of criticism, where they'll be, they could be thrown back up or they could be enjoyed. You never know. But I have no way of comparing what it would be like to write pre-COVID to COVID. COVID is all I've known. So for me, it'll be the post-COVID writing that will feel strange for me.
Now, I want to talk about negative reviews, which are never popular. They're particularly unpopular with authors, but they're also not necessarily greeted with enthusiasm by readers or publishers. This year, though, I've fielded more vitriolic responses to negative reviews than ever before. And I've seen this play out on social media as well. And the thinking seems to be that in these times of real crisis for authors, as well as many other people, critics and editors with bad news to deliver would probably do better to just sit on their hands. You've been in this industry for a long time. I'm really interested in what you make of this proposition that critics should hold their fire if they don't have anything good to say.
I think criticism must always remain true to its values, which, in my opinion, the role of the critic is to engage with a work honestly and openly, explicate that work, analyse it, suggest to people how they might find a key into that work, a way in, set that work in context, talk about it. Negative reviews per se are not a bad thing. I think it's very rare to come across a work that one can be wholeheartedly celebratory about. And I would argue that the best reviews are the reviews that are not afraid to suggest areas where there may have been lapses, areas where there may be problematic perspectives, voices, areas that may have been, perhaps should have been thought through a little bit better. In terms of vitriol, I think I've got two things I think to say about that. If I take your point, the vitriolic attacks on the critics who have written negative reviews, that to me just seems to feed into everything else about this year, this partisanship, this black and white, this total, if you're not with us, you're against us, which is completely and utterly useless as a way of engaging in debate and going forward and understanding what's happening in any industry or any particular work of art. I would also say, though, in terms of reviewing, I think reviewers need to always understand that there is a person or there are persons who have made that work of art, so you need to be aware of that. So in terms of doing a review that's intensely negative, I would say if you can't find anything positive to say about this book, and since we have got such limited space in our literary conversation to review book, we're talking about books largely, or rather not theatre, whatever, then if you are going to go ahead and do that review, you need to say very clearly what your position is, what your speaking position is, why you have found issues with this book that were so negative. And I'd say don't not do the review, but if you do the review, keep the emotive language out of it. Stay objective, stay slightly distanced. Make an argument, make a coherent, ethical, considerate argument of why this particular text really was so extremely problematic to you as a reader. And I think that's a good thing, because you should always be able to respect the critic and know that the critic doesn't just roll over, oh, I'm going to give a nice soft one about this one. The critic needs to be able to say, this is my brand, if you like, this is who I am, and trust me, I will be honest about this work. But you just need to be very careful, I think, in structure and in language if you are going to do a very negative review.
It's very interesting that we live with the internet, where a lot of these conversations ferment. And I find that interesting because if you look at the internet, you have a chronology and a history of everything that's been recorded and uploaded to the World Wide Web. And yet we keep buying into this pyramid scheme where everything is a catastrophe that's only happening now. And then we sell the catastrophe to an audience who then commentates on it. But if you look at the archives, people have bemoaned the state of criticism as not being negative enough or being too negative for decades. And I especially like, actually, the counterpoint to those who say, oh, criticism is too negative, which I don't understand, because criticism is not criticism unless it's something other than PR. It has to be a separate, well, it is a separate discipline. I mean, that's the point, and it predates PR. PR is the kind of new kid on the block who probably needs to sit down and take a moment to reflect. For the critic, your fidelity is to the book and that's all there is to it. It's a communion between you and the book. And I think that there's a long history of critics complaining that, in fact, people are not negative enough. Certainly there are many people who feel, well, they feel the Australian scene is quite chummy and not negative enough, although I think there's no need to be parochial about it. All scenes see themselves as not negative enough. And I remember, well, Elizabeth Hardwick wrote a nice piece, I think that was in the 50s, talking about how every book is born into a puddle of treacle as soon as it arrives on the scene. And it's the critic's job just to have a good faith, to approach the book in good faith and to write about it as with as much fidelity to what they've read as they can. And it's nothing to do with whether that's negative or positive. It's not about a gladiatorial scene where we award thumbs up and thumbs down. And in fact, that is closer to a form of PL or denuded criticism that I don't think is helpful. And in fact, I would add that negative reviews serve a great purpose. And in terms of publishing bottom lines, negative reviews, good or bad, by the way, can often help to sell a book, which is one of the ironies that we have. People might complain about them, but you will see many negative reviews leading to more sales of the book that has been negatively reviewed. And really, the question is not whether a review is positive or negative, but like the book itself, is this a good review? And there are forms of critical watchdogs at the Sydney Review of Books, with Ben Etherington, which is very helpful and interesting to read. And it does give a sense of that long history of the reception of books. So I would say that there's nothing wrong with a negative review, and saying a review is negative or positive is fairly meaningless. It's really, was it a good review? In the same critical sense, we'd ask, is a book successful as a book?
So if I'm understanding you correctly, you're thinking about negative evaluations and this complex ethical relationship between critics, authors, and readers hasn't changed a great deal with the advent of COVID.
It's very important that we distinguish between the marketing and the industry around being an author and the work of being an author. And the work of being an author is a separate thing, which is namely that you can write Hamlet tomorrow and it might never sell. And it wouldn't even matter whether you receive good reviews or terrible reviews. People might simply not buy the book. I'd actually say that it's more important that we have criticism in a form that is ethical in the sense that it isn't PR shill, that it's not marketing, and that it is a, as far as it can be, a neutral approach to the book. Why this is important and why I think this actually helps the business side of things, if we want to think of it in terms of the bottom line, is that for a book to be reviewed at all is a great privilege. And it's very important to always be cognizant that no one is entitled to write or publish anything, any less than, you know, you're entitled to be literate. You're literate because you live in a privileged society. And if you've had your book reviewed, which you've written because you became literate and you were able to write a book and have it published, then for that book to be reviewed at all is a massive privilege, regardless of the nature of the review. There's so many books, terrible books, wonderful books, it doesn't really matter, that aren't reviewed at all. Maybe not even by the sort of Books and Publishing or Kirkus Reviews, the industry publications that try to cover as more than almost anyone else can. There's so many books that will be reviewed only by them or not at all. And so to be written about and to be reviewed, I think, is a great privilege and serves the purpose of marketing the book, regardless of whether the review is seen as being a positive or a negative one.
So I'm interested in how you see the relationship between criticism and book publicity, whether you think critics have a role to play in selling books or moving units? What you might say to readers or authors who would ask of critics to be like more eloquent PR agents?
Simple answer, no. The criticism by itself is a discipline and an art. Criticism of a text, of a book, if we're talking literature, we're talking book publishing, particularly this year, criticism is not secondary per se. The book is primary. And my opinion is that the critic's role is to engage with that book and to talk about that book in a way that would interest readers to find out, oh, that's what's going on in that book. Not a descriptive review, but a review that says this is what's been published. And so in that way, the critic's job, to my mind, is to bring a work to the attention of readers. But it is not necessarily to sell that book. It is not necessarily, it's absolutely not tied, I think, to the PR. I realise the marketplace. I realise it comes down to dollars, and I realise that maybe critics need books to be published so that they've got a job. But that's actually, I think, irrelevant. The primary role of the critic is just to be honest and engage with the work and not pay any attention whatsoever to who the publisher is or who the writer is or whether they're going to be able to sell more books or not.
I have no personal experience of marketing or PR and the industry behind it, but I understand, like many occupations I've never been involved in, that it exists and it has a world that is unknown to me, but that I take it is, you know, just as I walk on the street, but I've never labored to build a street myself, I can't speak to the machinations of how that world works, except to say that I assume it is working, and that if there's anything there that isn't working, then that can be handled by the people who work in that industry. Criticism is a separate profession. I do see it as a form of art. It is a piece of writing that's as valid as any other piece of published writing. And it's more important to the health of literature that we write good criticism on our own terms, because the PR takes care of itself. The blurb is on the book. The glowing sort of commentary from other authors is there on the cover of the book or through Google if you have internet access. And so I feel that the critic's job really has to stay separate. It has nothing to do with PR or marketing. If there is a marriage between the two, then that's a happy coincidence, where if I as a critic love a book, then I'm happy to say so, just as a reader is happy to tell their friends that they loved what they've just read. But a reader never necessarily thinks that they're doing free publicity any more than I imagine my commission is intended to be marketing for a publisher. So I trust the marketing gurus to take care of the PR, and I'll take care of the critique, which, if it's particularly good critique, I'm not saying this in my own writing, but if a critique does its job well, hopefully it can even be read 5, 10, 50, even 100 years into the future and be enjoyed just as a book itself can. And that's really, I think, what you have to have fidelity to, is approaching the book in good faith and writing something that can be read and enjoyed beyond the marketing and the celebration or condemnation of the moment.
Here in Australia, the literary world is really, really small, and potential for conflict of interest is rife. Critics, if they don't themselves have a book that might be reviewed, colleagues or friends or neighbours or ex-partners of people who have books ready to review. And the pool of people judging literary prizes, writing criticism, editing journals, organising festivals is really, really small. And there's a strong perception that it's a bit of a closed shop. How do you deal with these perceptions, or indeed the reality of it being a small world? And how do you balance critical independence with connections and responsibilities to the literary community?
Fantastic question. There is no doubt that the Australian literary community is a fishbowl. No doubt. And I mean, one answer to that is to say it's a constant jiggle and a constant dance to find the right space to land in this fraught landscape of being a critic, peer reviewing, judging. If I split them up, so at the moment I'm a judge on the Miles Franklin Award. I don't find that a conflict of interest or a problem in that there are five judges. So my opinion matters. Everybody takes it extremely seriously. Everybody reads the books at least three times. Three out of the five have to read a book before it's dismissed. And then everybody reads and rereads the long lists and the short lists. And there's debate and argument. So that, for me personally, is not a conflict because I don't feel that I owe anybody anything except the reading community and the historical prestige of the award, I think, to be honest and to strive for the best. In terms of reviewing friends, I've always tried not to, and I do remember being asked to review, I can't actually remember which book it was now. It was a couple of years ago for Australian Book Review, and I was asked to review a book, and I really did want to do this review because I was very interested in what this book did. And I actually, for the first time, wanted to start this review with, I am a friend of this writer. And I thought that would be okay, but actually the editor then said, no, well, you can't review the book. And I accepted that perfectly well. I think if you're going to review a book and you are a friend or an ex-partner or whatever your relationship is with the person, you firstly need to make that very obvious. There has to be, as always, an acknowledgement of where you're coming from and what your agenda might be. Now, hopefully you can be independent, but then you can't sometimes. There have been occasions when I have been asked to review a book which I have had very negative responses to books in particular. I was thinking, I've had very negative responses, and I have contacted the editor and said, are you sure you want me to do this? Because this could be fraught in this fishbowl. And each time that editor has said, yep, be brave. So the way I found to do that was different ways, and I won't sort of identify the books, but my role then was to try something new. So read more of that writer's work, set my argument within a context of a larger oeuvre, or take a different perspective and set up a conversation in a different way. But it's not easy. And I would like not to review close friends' books because I think it's very rare that we read a book and really do think this is fantastic. These days, I just do. It's few and far between these days that I read and think, oh my goodness, this has, you know, blown me away. So you can do a beige review and that might be enough, but it's, you know, probably a bit unpolitic to say, but it's just the truth.
The most important thing is to have as many friends as possible who don't read, to have as many anchors as possible outside the scene of literature or any occupation for that matter. That won't necessarily help the part about having connections and a connection to the literary scene. So the balance is one you can never entirely maintain. There will always be limits to what you can do perhaps as a practitioner critic. And in fact, many authors would be no doubt curious to know how someone like Machiko Kakutani would have been if they had to publish themselves. Certainly, there are contemporary critics like James Wood who are practitioners and critics, and I consider myself a practitioner and a critic. I don't see myself purely as a critic. I would say that the echo chamber is global. Again, it's not a parochial thing, and I think it helps. I mean, for me, if the question comes up, who is the James Wood of Australia, then I would say James Wood, because it's a cosmopolitan sense that we are globally in the same thing together, notwithstanding that very little literature and writing, sadly, is translated into English, although, of course, a lot of English is translated into other languages. We are a global community, and we're not simply a small scene in all of the countries who could say, well, unfortunately, we're not New York. I guess we'd just better be nice then and content ourselves with mediocrity. Instead, you've really got to understand that it's a conversation we're all involved in. And the echo chamber has always been there. I don't want to catastrophize too much about how things are now, particularly because it is the pyramid scheme that can be bought into of saying, well, this is the worst it's ever been. In fact, which is very similar to the type of criticism that wants to tell you that Pride and Prejudice has just arrived, you know, every second year, that it's not the worst of times now, just because we're living in them. It is a time when it's important to have friends outside the literature scene and to ask yourself, again, what is the inheritance that you have and what is it that brought you to the profession? Why are you doing this? And most importantly, as a reader who has the privilege to write, what are you trying to achieve? And so I would just think in terms of the long durée of it's beyond your own lifetime, and you need to have a relationship with people you'll never meet across the globe and people you don't even know if you're writing for, all the readers you'll never know about, and stick with that. Many things and that inhabit the echo chamber pass. In fact, it's interesting, just when I was thinking about this, to look back at how much trench warfare happens and then disappears within a few days. It's actually going to be interesting, I think, as we accumulate all of this history online, to look back at the annals of online warfare and think, why on earth was that person attacking that person, and for what? Both of them will end up doing whatever they were going to do regardless.
So there's a conversation underway about diversity and criticism, which predates this COVID year, but it's certainly intensified and gained greater visibility and moral force in the wake of Black Lives Matter in particular. And what I see is critics and also editors like me being held to account in new ways for the work that they do. So critics and publications are being scrutinised for the diversity of books being reviewed, and questions are being asked about the cultural backgrounds that critics bring to reviews. Have these conversations, and particularly Black Lives Matter, shifted the way you think about your practice or shifted the way you work this year?
I wouldn't say they've shifted, but that's partly because every day is Black Lives Matter. It's not something of a moment for those who've always had to live with a consciousness of whether their life mattered. So those conversations, when they do reach areas they haven't reached before, can arrive as a surprise. But I think it helps to kind of have a cold shower and remind yourself that the communities affected by it have been living, you know, with surprise since the day they were born, and probably won't become less surprised by the time they have to teach their kids about the world we're living in. So Black Lives Matter didn't change things for me. It certainly, though, does give a framework within which to have conversations, and I'm very happy that we are having these conversations and that we are introducing terminology that's been around for a long time, but it does come and make its presence felt in new spaces. I would say that when I write, when I wrote a review of an anthology curated by Alison Whittaker, Firefront, that was when Black Lives Matter was at its height, And it would have been remiss of me not to talk about what was happening. I could have certainly just talked about the poetry and not talked about the world into which it was being born. But I do like to read and write in a way that speaks to the times in which you're living. And that's part of, I guess, that materialist sense, materialist in the political sense of being connected to the material ways in which we live and the privileges like literacy and the fact I'm able to publish it all, and to not squander that inheritance and that privilege. So it's a matter of every day Black Lives have to matter. And every day you write with that consciousness. And sometimes you have a chance to put those conversations into the public sphere. It is a big part of something that books talk to. And it is a big part of my practice, but it certainly wasn't something that happened this year. And I certainly hope that Black Lives Matter doesn't become something that just happened and remains in the past tense. Because for communities who can afford to forget about it, that is always the temptation. And it has been the temptation for centuries. But there's always the hope for the communities who are affected that temptation one day won't be given into.
I'm not so sure that it's shifted it very far at all, because I was always aware of this entrenched inequality. I'm more excited, but then I think I live in a bit of a bubble. I'm more excited that I think we can never go back to not hearing these voices. We also have, in Australia, and we're talking Australian literature, we have the most extraordinary range of voices publishing now. And we therefore need an extraordinary range of critics to engage with those voices. So I don't know that my ideas about criticism have changed as such. I do celebrate the fact that it's no longer okay to have a critic give a review of a book, a play, when they are too far distanced from that book and play, and that from now on there has to be that deeper thinking of cultural, structural, institutional inequalities and blindness, absolute blindness. We live in our bubbles. I think I will never, ever know what it's like to be abused for the colour of my skin. I have felt uncomfortable being white when I'm sitting with Yolngu mob up in Arnhem Land, and that's great, but they're generous, open people welcoming me to their land. I'm not walking down the street and encountering that every day. I am not writing a book where I am being dismissed for the colour of my skin. So I have no right to speak about those kinds of experiences, I don't think.
I think you've more or less answered my next question about the circumstances under which you think a critic should say no to reviewing a given book.
Ah, yes. Well, I think that's just a very easy one. You just say, well, you say no if that person is someone very, very close to you and you're not comfortable with doing that. But you say no when you say, here's a new book by a Wiradjuri writer. Here, would you like to review it? You say, well, no, who have you asked before me? Have you asked other Wiradjuri writers? Have you asked other critics who have more of a connection to this story or to this publication than I do? I am not the right person for this book. There are books when you just think, I am not the right person here. Yes, I could write a review. Yes, I could read this. Yes, I could give my opinion. My opinion is not worth it, I think, in that instance. Someone else's, in the space that we have, which is so limited for criticism, someone else's voice is far more valid than mine.
Personally, I have a strong belief that criticism, like all art, needs to have blood running through its veins. There's a great essay Maria Tamarkin wrote about Michael Hoffman, which speaks about this idea that you really should feel awakened and enlivened when you read something. So I have said no to reviewing certain things. And the circumstances in which I would say no are if a piece of art doesn't inspire strong feelings. Now, this is an interesting balance because George Orwell wrote a great piece about the person who's a working critic who naturally has to read many things that don't inspire any feeling at all, but still has to produce content about these things and manufacture feelings. I try as much as possible never to manufacture feelings. And if I ever read something where I felt I had no strong impression from this at all and I would not be able to talk about it without manufacturing feelings, I really would feel that it was just a lack of integrity and I would probably try and avoid having to write that review. That would be one circumstance. The other circumstance, and I've heard about this from other critics, is when a book simply does nothing for you, perhaps even inspires very strongly negative feelings to the degree where you wouldn't be able to write a informed negative criticism, because there's very few times when, I should say at this juncture, I don't believe in such things as a hatchet job. I think that the most negative examples of criticism that exist still come from a place of genuine engagement. It's possible to write a poor review, but that's a separate issue. There are many terrible reviews written all over the world that are positive, but people don't tend to condemn them. I wouldn't be afraid of a negative review unless it was a poor review, which is a separate thing. Many hatchet jobs are very well written and engaged. You don't have to agree with them, but you can at least respect that the author has taken the time to read and write about the work, notwithstanding that the author personally may not be too happy about it. I would turn down books where, not because I thought I'm going to write a negative review, but because I thought there was nothing that I could say which would not have its own separate integrity in the sense of being engaged, in the sense of being productive as a piece of negative critique, which so many so-called hatchet jobs can be. And of course, many hatchet jobs stand up as a lesson to the wider culture long after a lot of positive reviews have faded from collective memory. So there are some circumstances where I have turned down books, and that's normally because I felt like there was no blood in my veins that could write anything that was worth hearing. And that comes back to the privilege of taking up space and speaking at all. I'm not entitled to have my voice heard in and of itself. I have to have something to say. So I won't write about anything unless I can engage with it in good faith and speak about it. And perhaps if I had nothing productive to say, then I would try to avoid writing those reviews.
Something I'm hearing a lot more about now is culturally informed criticism. And it's become apparent to me that different critics mean different things when they talk about culturally informed criticism. And to close, I wonder what this term means to you.
The first thing I think of when I hear culturally informed criticism immediately is my own bubble, my sense that I am informed, I am aware, I do realise the ethics, the sensitivities, the cultural disparities, the injustices, all of those things, and therefore I'm aware of where I'm coming from. And the next second is, no, you're not. You have a set of values, you've got a set of ideas, you've got a perspective that, yes, may be more informed than some others, but is always blind to certain aspects. So culturally informed criticism, I say it is criticism that is aware of difference. It's aware of lack in oneself, but also aware of the richness of opportunity in terms of voices, experience, literary form. Culturally informed criticism has to be criticism that is sensitive to the cultural specifics of the text. But I would also say probably at every point for myself, and I can only speak for myself, no matter how educated, informed I think I am, I'll know that I'll find a blind spot at some point without realizing it. And that's a good thing. That's an uncertainty. That's a constantly keeping yourself on edge, thinking, okay, what have I missed here? Because I can't see this because my experience is such that I can't.
Culturally informed criticism is about the responsibility you have to the book. Each book that we read comes from and is the product of a certain culture. We talk sometimes in these debates about transcending identity and transcending culture. And there's that idea about we must protect the great white men. They're not all so bad, but these rebellious left-wing types, they want to tear it all down. Now, obviously, this is a straw man idea because all of us have identities. It's just a matter of whether we want to acknowledge it or not. And there's nothing scary about acknowledging your identity. So the only way to write any criticism is to be culturally informed, because there's nothing that can be read which is not part of and born into a particular culture. I think that it's also part of the privilege and honor of being written about. That might sound grandiose, but the fact is many books are never reviewed, and that's regardless of their quality. So we need to ask ourselves, what is it that's being reviewed? Why is it that's being reviewed? And why is it that we get caught up in debates about the nature of the review and not about the question of all of the writing that is produced that never gets spoken about at all? The interaction that those conversations have with culturally informed critique is that a culturally informed critic can bring to bear on the novel or the work of nonfiction or the play or any cultural product, they can bring to bear all of those aspects of culture, or as many as they can within a limited word count. And they can really talk about the work in its most panoramic form. And I think it does justice to what the creator would want for the work. Any creator has lived usually some time before they produce any artistic artifact. And again, it would be remiss for any critic to come along and presume to speak about something when they haven't honored the fact of the author writing within and talking about a certain context. That doesn't mean we need to be parochial. It doesn't mean that we need to say only X can speak about Y, but it does mean that X needs to inform itself of the context that Y is coming from and write its critique accordingly. It is not a matter of whether they agree or disagree, but they need to be informed about what has gone into the work on a macro level, because to do anything else would be to diminish the work, and moreover, it would be to, in a sense, not even have read the work, perhaps to end up speaking at cross purposes, which is often how many straw man arguments end up sort of coalescing and collapsing. Everyone wants to speak at cross purposes and never to humble themselves enough to look outside their own necessarily straightened context and background and try to meet the work on its own terms.
Thank you both. That was Bernadette Brennan and Declan Fry in conversation with me, Katrina Menzies-Pike, for the Sydney Writers Festival podcast.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.